Lawyers switched jobs significantly less in the early 1980s, which was a good thing because it took a lot more work for recruiters to find them and contact them. I'm Stephanie Francis Ward, and on today's episode of the ABA Journal's Asked and Answered, we're discussing executive search work and how much it has changed over the years. My guests today are Valerie Fontaine, a principal of Los Angeles Seltzer Fontaine, and Marina Siris, who is based in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Tell me about cold calling candidates pre-internet, because you had to get through the fortress, right?
I started in this business in 1986. And the way that we got candidates, Martindale Cobble came out once a year in October. And what we would do is divide the list of new entries, and I was with a larger recruiting firm, and we would cold call every single person to find out, because associates were not, you got the year that they were born, the year that they were admitted to the bar, the firm that they were with. So we had to call them and find out what specialty they were working in.
So, okay, the associates' bios were not listed in Martindale Hubble, so you had to call everyone.
Every one of them.
How many calls was that, like, a day?
Oh, hundreds sometimes. If you could get them on the phone. And back then, they did answer their telephone.
The secretaries answered the telephones. We had to get through the secretaries.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So you had to go through that hurdle first. But if you did get them on the phone, they were chatty. They would tell you about themselves. They would tell you about what specialized in. And languages that they spoke, all of that.
Did you keep a list of the people you'd called the year before so you didn't call them again?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. So you were calling all first year associates. Mahub. Remember Mahub? Mahub.
Yes.
And maybe we should explain for the younger people Do you want to explain? I don't want to say you want to explain what Martindale Hubble is, because it kind of hurts my heart. But Valerie,
yes,
would you like to take that?
I actually started in legal recruiting in November of 1981. So I might not be older than you, Marina, but I've been doing this longer. This is my 40th year this month.
Yes, absolutely.
In recruiting. Martindale Hubble was a set of very fat directories with very thin pages. Think of an old-fashioned big dictionary. And you would take the volume for your state and put it on your lap and open it up and start calling. And then you would make a Rolodex card or an index card that would then be filed so that we would keep track of who did what. It would go under the litigators, under the labor and employment people, under the corporate people, whatever. And so that is how you would keep track of folks. And like Marina said, we had to find out what they did, and we had to find out a lot about them. But first we had to get through their secretaries, which was a feat in itself, because the assistant's job was to, you know, keep out people like us. And I had a colleague who did some very inventive things. Some people would use different names, so they wouldn't keep calling the same firm
yes,
using the same name, you know. And I never did that because I couldn't keep it straight. I just used my own name. So that meant I had to jump around from firm to firm. I couldn't keep calling the same one after another. But also, you know, this one colleague was very inventive, and she would call and say, oh, well, tell whoever it was, him, it's the doctor's office. And then, or if it was even more difficult to get through, she goes, well, just tell him I have the results of the test he was waiting for. And I would be shocked and appalled that she would do that, but it would get people on the phone.
Well, so I'm curious, at some point when you called and someone had a really good secretary, they're like, yes, I know it's Valerie with an E.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Would you also try to make friends with the secretaries?
Sometimes, but their job was to keep us out.
Well, I'm curious, what if you called somebody and you chatted them up and it turned out, oh, well, I went to an unranked law school, or, you know, I didn't pass the bar until my fifth try. Would you just be like, okay, thanks, and move on? Or, I mean, because you didn't know, because it Martindale Hubbell didn't have...
Well, they did have the admission
year. Okay.
Right.
But they didn't say where they went to law school.
Yes, they did. They did. Yeah.
Oh, it did say they went to law school. Okay.
They gave you a number of the law school, a number of the undergrad school, and a number of the law school, and we had to look that up.
Okay. All right. So. And I'm curious, if say you found somebody like who was a Harvard grad, would you say, who else was in your class?
We always do that.
No. You did? I didn't do
that. No, you always ask, who do you know? Who would you recommend? Who do you think I should call? And then you can, then when you got a secretary and an associate or an assistant, you could say, oh, Joe Schmo told me to give so-and-so a call. And that always helped.
Oh, that's a good trick, Valerie.
Well, it's about time we learned some new tricks, huh?
Yes.
Well, yes. Say I was a third-year associate in 1987, and I wanted to switch firms. What should I do?
Call me.
And
absolutely.
And what would you tell me?
We would leave our number.
But then what? How did the process work?
Okay. Well, we always would want to get a resume. And getting a resume was a whole different scene than it is today. Because someone would have to write up a resume and then they would have to mail it to us. First, they would have to get it typed up. They would take it to a place like a Kinko's or something. I can't even remember when Kinko's opened. They would have to get it printed. Heaven forbid there'd be a typo in it. They'd have to get more printed. They'd have to mail a number of the resumes to us because we would then have a cover letter typed up, which then had to be mailed to the law firm. This is before fax machines, don't forget. So a phone call would lead to getting a resume from the candidate in about 2 to 3 weeks and get it to the law firm in 2 to 3 or more weeks. Not like today, where you can call somebody up, get it zapped right to you, you get it right to the law firm. You can do that within minutes. It would take weeks and lots of stamps and trips to the post office or a messenger.
You probably had a lot of candidates then, too, who couldn't type.
Well, I couldn't type. Yeah, that's a problem. You have to get somebody who could type. I can now.
Okay.
I can now sort a keyboard, but.
Okay.
Yes. You have to learn how to type on purpose. So when you would apply for a job, they always asked you, how many words do you type? And my answer was, I don't type because I did not want to be a secretary or a nurse.
Yeah.
I wanted to be more than that.
What about for resume design? Because people, you couldn't really design. I guess you could design your own resume, but it's not like it is now. Did you guys offer those services with your businesses?
Oh, we would do resumes, absolutely. But we needed to get all of the material from them. So they first had to send us their version of it. And then we revised it into a format that we had.
How did you find out then what the firms wanted? And I wouldn't imagine maybe that hasn't changed much in terms of what the firms are interested in and what they need at the moment.
Phone calls. You would call them.
And getting very friendly with the recruiters at the various firms, taking them to lunch and everything. And then they would respond to your calls and tell you about what they were looking for, what openings they had. It isn't like now where that you cannot get a recruiter on the phone unless you have a candidate that they're interviewing.
Really?
So it's very difficult. You do need to build a relationship, but back then it was easier than it is today.
Why do you think that is?
There wasn't as much lateral movement, so they weren't as busy. In fact, quite often, the recruiting person was some partner's secretary.
Yes.
Is part of it, too, because they don't want to pay a fee? They'd rather just handle it internally?
Oh, no, they love paying. It was easy to pay a fee. It was easy to get, it was easy. If they had the right candidate, they messengered the check to us in New York on the day that the candidate started. We did not have fee agreements. We did not have any of the stuff. We have 5- and 6-page fee agreements.
But
right
we
now.
Always had fee agreements. We did.
But they were one page.
They were one page. But you have to remember, Stephanie, that there wasn't as much lateral movement at all. When I started recruiting, it was really very new that associates would move. Partners weren't moving. It was just associates. So it was a new thing altogether. Correct. I think legal recruiting really started in the very late 70s, and I started doing this in 1981. So there just wasn't a lot of lateral movement. What would happen was lawyers would join a law firm out of school. They would wait, be there, say, 6 to 8 years, make partner. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't make partner, they were out. But generally speaking, they made partners and they stayed there until they either retired or died at their desks. There wasn't a lot of movement.
What are some things that are acceptable now for mid-level and senior associate candidates that maybe wouldn't have been acceptable? That wouldn't have been acceptable in the 1980s. And I'm thinking in my mind of that question that now probably a lot of things are acceptable in part because people need bodies. But say in the past, like 2 years, what would you say is acceptable now that the firms would have been no back in the 80s?
Just having had more than one job in the 80s, making a move at all was quite a surprise. And so having a couple of previous jobs was quite suspect. Also, taking time off for any reason and wanting to come back was quite suspect.
There was something that they called the two-year plan. So if you sent them a resume where they're, you know, for a fifth-year associate who's already made two moves and looking again, you know, it was anathema. You just didn't do that. We also used to really overanalyze the resume before we sent it out. Whereas now, if you get a corporate associate, they could have had three jobs in 5 years and you will get two offers. A mid-level associate is golden. And the other thing that's interesting is that the candidates don't hesitate to say, I want a signing bonus.
Oh, right.
Because my friend just moved and got a $100,000 signing bonus as a seventh-year associate.
And that just didn't happen.
It never happened before.
Well, do you find with the way the market is now, and it is very, very good, but also is it putting some people's expectations just out of whack? Because they hear that their friend got a $100,000 signing bonus, but they're not their friend.
Yes.
Can they? Depends on if they have the right credentials. They can get it. And we also don't hesitate to ask a firm if they are offering a signing bonus for this.
Well, I'm curious because you said few people moved and you certainly didn't want someone who had been at two or three firms. Say you had like, did they have six-year associates in the 80s or
No?
Okay. Say you're a six-year associate and you're looking for another job and everybody knows that's about the year you're getting considered for partner and you probably didn't get it. How did you place that person? Or they just went, like maybe instead of a top 10 firm, they started looking around for a top 20 firm.
Well, they would look at the top 200
right.
firm.
Right.
They would move
right.
down.
Unless the firm had a particular need, you know, in that particular area.
Exactly.
One of the things I wanted to talk about, Stephanie, that we haven't talked about is the fact that the associates did not know so much about other firms other than the one where they were from or at, because people didn't move, number one, but also because there were not websites. So there was no way for them to learn about the firms other than from us. And we'd have to educate
them. From the recruiters, absolutely.
Right. And so one of the things that we as recruiters were constantly doing, we're trying to get the law firms to write their own resumes, to put together, I mean, there was Martindale Hubbell that might have a list of their practice areas and a list of their partners, but to actually write a firm resume talking more about what their practice is, the sort of thing you now see on websites. And then we would have the firms would type those up, print them up, mail them to us. And then we had a printing service on Messenger that would come every week, that would come to us and pick up copies of those, the firm resumes that we use the most, and make multiple copies and bring them back to us so we could hand them to our candidates, our prospects, or mail them. We would put together these packages of firm resumes that we literally mail to the associates. This was after we'd already waited a couple of weeks for a resume. Mail them to the associates for them to consider whether they would be interested in applying to those firms. So, you know, you're asking why could we get the recruiting people on the phone? It's because everything moves so much more slowly then, you know, and there was just, it moved more slowly and there was a smaller volume. I mean, the amount of things that I do in a day here now, it would take me a month to do before computers and before email.
a lot of firms would have cocktail parties for recruiters. And the partners would be there, seniors, not senior associates, counsel. And most of the purpose was to actually pump us for information from other firms, about other firms, what their competitors were doing. Was it, you know, their recruiting practices, their practice areas. Or they would even call if you placed, you know, if you made some placements in one firm, the partners felt very comfortable to call up and say, tell us about, XY firm. So we were a source, not only for the candidates, but also for the partners. But the cocktail parties were a very frequent event.
Well, we called them the dog and pony shows. And that's how we got to know. That's how we got to know all the other recruiters in town, too, because they would invite us all in and they would also show off their partners. And that was another way we got to know them and because they wanted to sell their firms. Firms used to do that before the pandemic, but certainly not as frequently. It was just that was sort of an add-on to what we could get on the websites and that sort of thing. But in the old days, that was just a very important way for the firms to introduce themselves to search firms and to find out more about what was going on in the legal community altogether.
And taking a legal recruiter to lunch was the best way to learn about what they were doing, what they were planning, what strategy was about the growth of a practice area. So we did that on a regular basis.
Well, do you feel like as it becomes more safe to be out and about with people and the pandemic dies down and more people are vaccinated, are we going to go back to that time a little bit? Or do you think now that we can do so much remotely, we can find out so much stuff online, are we going to, is your business going to stay in many ways online with things you used to do in person?
I think that a lot of it is going to stay online. I mean, one of the things that we've been able to do remotely is we do Zoom or virtual meetings with our clients because we still like to do face-to-face meetings, but they're face-to-face via Zoom. Yes. And we get, you know, practice leaders and partners from all across the country or, you know, even around the world if necessary on that Zoom call. And we can, you know, talk to a whole bunch of them all at once. And it's been wonderful, actually. And I think that that is going to continue.
Well, now we see so many openings, opportunities at law firms where they say, you know, this could be a remote position from anywhere in the United States.
I just made a placement on Friday with a woman who is going to be working remotely from Maui with an LA firm.
From Maui.
She nice. Lives in Hawaii and is working for a Hawaiian firm. And she wants to work with a mainland firm. She started at a mainland firm and moved to Maui a number of years ago. And so she wants to stay in Maui, but she wants to do mainland law. And that's going to happen.
It's a different world. Yes.
So what percentage of your associate placements would you say during the pandemic, they haven't been in the office?
Most of them.
High percentage.
Yeah, most of them.
Like 90?
Oh, I'd say. Yes.
Probably. I placed a very senior M&A lawyer with a firm after one interview on Zoom. He met with two partners and they called at the end of the day to say, we really want to get to know him better. Would he consider joining us as a contract attorney for a time? So it was a firm that he was very interested in. And 3 months later, they hired him 2 weeks later because he had his own practice at the time. And 2 weeks later, they set him up where he does the work remotely. He works on unbelievable major deals, especially with the Asia partners. And it was 3 months later that he went into the office in New York City. He lives in New York. And he met the partner who hired him, the head of the practice, 3 months later. And he said it was kind of eerie to walk down the hallways of a major firm and you see maybe three doors open, maybe not. And it was meeting in the office so he could see the offices and then go to lunch. But prior to that, he was working for them for a very high rate at remotely.
I actually had a situation with a partner who had an offer from a firm. He had not met anybody in person at all. He wanted to see the LA office where he would eventually someday be. He asked if he could go in, and the managing partner of the LA office said, I'd be happy to meet him. But this was during lockdown. The general counsel of the firm said, nope, cannot go in.
No.
So the managing partner of Los Angeles walked around with his iPad and showed him all of the, this is here and this is there, and gave him a virtual tour of the office. So, I mean, people have been very creative with how they've been interviewing and doing things.
Based on your experiences, I mean, once things start to open up and it's more common, I mean, we keep hearing that firms want people to go back to the office, but they can't really demand it right now because the talent doesn't want to. But is this just going to be that the world is you don't, can you, I guess my question is do you think for lawyers in private firms, can you continue, do you think, to keep on working from home? Or there's also issues that maybe you won't be taken as seriously if you're not working from home, or you're going to miss out on opportunities if you're not working from home.
I think the world is going to be hybrid. It's going to be very hard to get associates to come into the office. I mean, we're actually doing some in-house searches that are very attractive, and candidates are turning it down because the company wants to have their attorneys in the office 5 days a week. And people are saying, no, I'm not going to do that. So that's difficult. I'm actually right now working with a partner with a big book of business. He wants to join a firm, but he wants to make sure that they're in the office and his associates will be in the office. And other law firms are saying, that's not what we're doing. We are not requiring that of our associates. So here is the candidate wants the people in the office, but the law firm itself says, we're not demanding that. And that's becoming a real problem. So yes, there are issues about people not, you know, being in the office. And yes, there are opportunities and things that sort of happen organically that aren't happening because they're not running into each other in the office. But also a lot of people see the real advantages of it. And it all depends, I think, on the firm itself, the practice and the personalities involved.
I think a lot of the not going into the office is driven by associates. Many of them have young families. It's great to work from home because they can get their work done in the evening. And, you know, they can go to the soccer game in the afternoon after school and see their child play. But I think it is going to, the day to go back in is just being stretched further and further. It was supposed to be after Labor Day in New York. And then it was the end of October. And then now it's January for most of them. But they still have not say we demand 100% presence in office.
What I am hearing is that some of the options are to have certain practice groups in on certain days so that they see each other. So that not everybody's in all the time and they're not required to be in all the time. But there are times where teams assemble and are there together.
I think the ones who are going to suffer are the juniors, the newbies, because their training is going to be very difficult. So, you know, discussions that we have with partners at firms, they have a concern about it also. You know, it's fine to be on a Zoom call with a team, but it's different than being in a Zoom call, being in a conference room speaking with everyone.
Well, do you think in-person training might be beneficial to your resume in a couple of years if you're a baby lawyer?
It may be. It may be.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how partner movement and general counsel placements have changed, as well as more on the current job market, because that is fascinating and unbelievable. We'll be right back.
Be the best resource you can for your Spanish-speaking clients with the Spanish Group's Legal Translation Service. Experienced translators ensure accurate translation of your documents with same-day delivery. Confidentiality is ensured, and the Spanish Group guarantees acceptance for certified translations. All that, and their rates are competitive. If you need other languages, the Spanish Group translates in over 140 languages. Mention Legal Talk 20 when you request your quote for 20% off your first translation. Visit thisspanishgroup.org.
It can be frustrating to wade through the malpractice insurance application process, but you know you need to protect your firm. Alps designed their application to be flexible, easy, and 100% online. Fill it out, review your quote, accept, and pay in as little as 10 minutes. Alps is the nation's largest direct writer of lawyers' malpractice insurance, and they are endorsed by more bar associations than any other carrier, so they understand law firms. They also know how valuable your time is, and that's why they make legal malpractice insurance easy. Visit alpsinsurance.com to learn more. That's alpsinsurance.com.
Delegate out those tasks that take up your time. Staffy can help you with your legal, administrative, marketing, and even client-facing workload. Hiring Staffy's top-notch bilingual virtual staff means Staffy does the recruiting, hiring, and training for you. Then, if you need a change, Staffy handles it. You get to concentrate on your strategic work. Schedule a free consultation at staffy.cc. That's STAFI.cc and get $500 off with code HAPPY24.
And we're back. This is Stephanie Francis Ward. And on today's episode of the ABA Journal's Asked and Answered, I'm talking about executive search work with lawyer placements and the changes that the work has gone through over the years. Joining me are Valerie Fontaine and Marina Siris. So we talked about associates for the last segment. If a partner left his or her firm in the mid-1980s to go to another firm, was that eyebrow raising? And people were like, well, what in the heck happened there?
Yes, it was. It was definitely eyebrow raising. As I said earlier, I started recruiting in 1981 and partners weren't moving at all. I think that two major things happened. One was the advent of the American Lawyer magazine, where there was a lot of transparency with regard to law firm finances, which had been completely a black box previously. And so other lawyers were looking around and their eyes were opened as to what some of their competitors were earning elsewhere. That was number one. But number two, a big thing that happened was when some law firms blew up. And I think the earliest and most shocking to the industry, because it was, I think, the first big firm to fall apart, was Kaplan Livingston. And when that happened and there were some really terrific lawyers with major books of business on the street, they had to go somewhere. And it turned out that it was a scramble for them. And that may have been, Marina, before you got in the business. I'm not sure. I don't remember the year.
With me, it was Finley Cumble.
Yes, it was Finley Cumble, because that was the next one.
Finley Cumble.
That was the next one. And when they fell apart, and there were a lot of partners and groups of partners who were scrambling to look, and nationally. Kaplan Livingston was in New York, but when Finley Cumble crumbled, then that was all around. And so I think that those two things really sort of opened the door for partner movement.
Yes. And it was also the getting out of lockstep for a lot of firms and paying, eat, you know, what you kill kind of a thing. If you brought in if you had a multimillion dollar practice, but you were only 10 years, a 10-year partner, you had to wait a long time to really benefit from bringing in that much business because the firm had lockstep partner compensation. And when they started changing that, there was a lot more movement.
I'm curious. So when one of the Am Law charts came out about lawyers and money, would you guys see an uptick in calls? Because they might read in Am Law, oh, well, I'm not at the median.
Oh, it was always a big thing when the new charts came out every year. It still is, actually. The firms are still jockeying for position. So then you take a look at, for recruiters, you take a look at the firms where if the profits per partner fell and look at the firms where profits per partner increased, and that sort of gave you an idea of where your recruiting targets might be and where your acquisition targets might be. So yes, and people would always be looking at them and reading them and either being happy or very sad. And yes, it did make a difference with regard to the number of calls you got.
And most of that was in the US.
How did you determine back then, and maybe it's still difficult, if the partner actually had the business he or she said they did? Because, I mean, frankly, I think it seems like some firms are still not so great at determining that. And sometimes in the business, it's fake it till you make it. But how did you, I mean, pre-internet, because you couldn't look up on Pacer and see like what cases this person was first chair on, for instance, or you couldn't, I guess you could look at the deal columns in the legal publications, but how did you determine if someone's book of business was actually what they said it was?
One of the things before the new laws about asking about compensation, you could ask what the compensation was. And if, and the law firms actually asked the candidates that they were serious about for copies of their tax returns.
Yes.
And if they were indeed getting paid a certain number, that let you know whether there was business to back that up. And if they say they had a multi-million dollar book of business, but they were making $300,000, something did not add up. So now you have to, and you did then, but I think now you have to be even more careful to ask questions like, how long have you been representing this client? Who do you know there? What kind of work do you get about from them? Do other lawyers in your firm work for this client?
On the same client.
Yes. Right. So you have to delve into the relationships that these partners have with their clients. And there, you know, you can only ask those questions and rely on the answers they give you. But also, and one of the things some firms did, and it's raised some eyebrows, is they would call some of the larger clients. You can't say, hey, are you going to bring the work with us? But you can just say, tell me, what do you think about this lawyer? And so they were calling under the guise of checking references.
Yes.
And they would get some information from some of the bigger clients themselves about what they thought about that lawyer. And that would let you know.
Straight from the client. Yes.
Yes. What kind of relationship they had and how likely it might be it would continue.
They also would arrange dinners with the prospectus, a partner from the prospective firm and the client. And, you know, it was just a get to know kind of a thing. But there was a lot of, you know, you were able to find out. The one thing that also, if you built a relationship with a partner and you ask them about their business, they love to tell you all about it. You know, what kind of deals.
But it may not be true.
Yes, of course, there's always that. And my cousins who were, you know, one was a banker, the other one was a partner at a big eight firm, could not understand how you could get a stranger on the phone and he'll tell you how much he was making, how many what kind of business he brought in. And it was easy. And that's what, you know, he said, here, it's just not done. But they would tell you all about it.
Right. It's amazing. It was always amazing to us. But the thing is, some recruiters have the ability to engage candidates and engender that kind of trust and respect, and you get that information right away. And some recruiters can't get anything and out of candidates, and they don't stay in the business very long. So, you know, it's just the ability to create rapport, establish rapport very early on. I mean, we make cold calls, and you know, we ask fairly personal questions.
Yes.
And we used to ask them what kind of money they make. Here in California, we can say, what are your compensation expectations?
And we do that now, yes.
Yes, and we can still ask that. And then sometimes they'll say, oh, I'd like to make whatever it is. And other times they'll say, oh, well, I make, and they'll tell me. And so I have to write down very quickly, so-and-so
volunteered
that they make such and such a, you know, amount of money. Because it's, you know, it's, you have to be very careful about it. But, you know, compensation expectations and what they're currently making really give you a very good clue about what they're worth to their firm. And what they're worth to their current firm has a lot to do with what they bring in.
And we also advise them that the one thing they cannot do are ask their counsel or the contract partner that works on their practice or the associates. They cannot invite them to join them when he leaves until he's out the door. And that is very important because there have been lawsuits. Firms have sued partners who have left because they did poach the firm before they left.
I have the impression that usually when a partner is leaving a law firm, it's because he or she feels that they're not getting a fair shake. I mean, would you agree with that and say that has not changed over the years you've been doing this?
There are a number of reasons why people leave. And sometimes a client conflict arises. Sometimes they are not in agreement with the direction, management direction of the firm. They're either the firm's opening up too many offices or not opening up enough offices, or, you know, not giving them the kind of support in terms of associates they need. There are a lot of different reasons. It's not just money, but money's a big one.
Money is probably number one, but there's also the depth of the platform where they're going, of the practice where they're going, also the opportunity to head up that practice. If they have enough business, they could go in on a you know, very prominent role. So there's a lot of that. And of course, if you're in your mid-40s and you have a multi-million dollar business, you're very attractive to many firms because they want to have you there for a number of years. We have one client now that really hasn't done very much about succession. And in trying to recruit for them, because the heads of the practice are one retired, the other one's about to retire, it's very difficult to recruit for them because there is no real head of the practice that's left behind. So there's a lot of planning, strategy, all of that to be done, and then not have to be concerned if retirement comes in the way or any other issue comes in the way and they have to leave.
I would imagine that back when you guys both started, there was recruitment for service partners, but I have the impression that that has really died out. Is that correct?
I don't think there's ever been a huge recruitment call for service partners.
Okay.
Because as one partner told us at a NALSC conference, I think this was the one in New Orleans, one of the partners said to us recruiters, look, we don't need you to bring us smart lawyers and good lawyers. We expect all of your candidates are going to be that. What we want you to bring us are good clients. What we're really recruiting are the clients, not the lawyers. And that was an interesting comment, because he's like, I assume they're good lawyers. And of course, if they're not good lawyers, they won't have a good client base. But he said, what we really want is the clients. And I thought he was putting it very boldly and being very, very clear about it. And it's something that definitely stuck in my head.
It took me a second to understand. Yeah, but yeah, that is fascinating.
Back in the 80s, they used to say those who get and those who do, because they were the partners that would bring the business in, and they were plenty of partners that could work on their clients. But it was a special art to get someone who really was very good at developing business.
Right. Well, I heard the minders, grinders, and binders.
There were those two.
Right. So it's like grinders were the doers, and they weren't, you know, worker bees have never been as valued, unfortunately, and they're necessary.
To be someone that the firms are interested in as a lateral partner now on this market, what size does your book need to be in this market, do you think? And has it gone up or down?
Depends on the firm.
Yeah, depends on the firm, depends on how profitable the work is. You know, there's different numbers for different practice areas and also different economic models at different law firms. So while a partner can be extremely profitable at one firm, that partner, same partner, may not be as profitable at another. So profitability is actually the key, not necessarily the size, because somebody might have a $5 million book of business, but it takes a lot of lawyers at low rates to generate it. That's not profitable. You want somebody who has a $5 million book of business that is done by one or two people. Then you've got a profitable practice. So that's what's very important. One of the things we haven't talked about that's really changed is way back when, there were partners and associates, and that's it. maybe there was a senior counsel or of counsel, and that was somebody who was really sort of semi-retired. Now you've got all these different slices and dices of different kinds of partners. Are they equity partners, non-equity partners? Are they of counsel? And what does that mean? It means something different in every single firm. There are different layers of associates. There's all different ways now to structure a law firm. And so that's made things a little more complicated because people are sometimes moving for a different title. They really want, they're not going to be able to change title and get up to the next tier in their current firm. And they want to, you know, get equity, or they know they're never going to move into the partner tier at all at their current firm. And they may want to go somebody else, somewhere else to get there.
Mm-hmm. Could you move from like a staff lawyer position to an associate track job or partner track rather?
You can these days, depending on what it is you're doing.
Ah.
Yeah, it depends on the area of practice.
If you're an intellectual property practice, if you have a science background, if you have all of that, the demand for the book of business is lower, first of all. But there are a lot of practice areas that benefit from an intellectual property department. So one of the things that also, I'm jumping around, that partners candidates ask for is they want to meet their marketing department at the prospective firm, or their business development department. They don't want to just go in blind. They really want to see what the firm offers and how his practice will benefit from it.
Right. Or what kind of budget they're going to get. And they want to hear from other laterals what their experience has been in terms of integrating and expanding their book of business. And that's another way that firms can compete. One of the things I wanted to say about these equity and non-equity and positions is now there is sort of a tier and a place for lawyers who are not the big business developers, and that's in the non-equity tier. But the recruiting is much less active there, unless sometimes they go along with an equity partner, where you've got sort of the marquee partner who has then a group that helps to service the book that's moving. And in that group, there is like the first lieutenant who might be a non-equity partner and then several associates. And again, as Marina said, that equity partner cannot recruit the group before he or she gives notice to the firm. But as a practical matter, once that partner has given notice to the firm, the group will move because that's all the work they're doing. I mean, there's not going to be work left for them at their current firm if they don't go with the partner that's moving.
Hmm. And firms do everything possible to hold on to those clients and not have them leave with the partner.
Has that changed over the years or not? Maybe people...
Not much.
Has that changed?
No.
It's all the same. It'll come down to money.
I would say just everything is faster and more cutthroat these days.
I'm curious, and this, I guess this would be a pandemic-related question, instinctively knowing if someone is probably a right fit, has that changed over the years? Is it all the same? And is it the same in person when you're meeting them at a restaurant as it might be on Zoom when you're seeing them on a screen?
Well, we always try to meet our candidates and our clients, made every effort to do that. The pandemic has really played havoc on that part. So we were placing a partner who had not really met any partner from the prospective firm in person. So he really wanted to meet someone. So he and the managing partner met in Bryant Park in New York City and sat on a park bench 6 feet apart and chatted away. He didn't even go into the office, but he did make the move.
Right. Yeah, we've been having people meet at, you know, Starbucks outside.
Outside.
That sort of thing. We make sure we meet our candidates one way or another and our clients. And that's why we've been doing a lot of Zooming. Mm-hmm. And our candidates and clients have been Zooming with each other. I do agree that you learn a lot more quickly in person than over a Zoom, but you learn more over a Zoom than you do from a telephone call. So, you know, you just try to to get as much information as you can. Part of what we do as recruiters is we are the human touch, and we are expected to match not just, you know, the credentials, but also the chemistry. And there are certain personalities and certain kind of people that work better at one firm than another. I mean, we've known, sometimes we've met somebody and we said, oh, that's an XYZ firm person. That is that kind of a person. Or, you know what, he or she is just not going to fit at this firm. And there's all sorts of intangibles that go into that. It's not just, you know, where have they practiced? What kind of law do they practice? Where do they go to school? You know, sometimes it's as interesting as, are there a lot of people in that branch of the military where this candidate had been in that branch of the military? I made a placement where we opened up the LA office for a firm where our candidate had been a former Marine. And as it turned out, the partners at the law firm back east, a lot of them are Marines. Well, there's a lot that goes into that personality type. Mm-hmm. And that made a perfect match. You know, and he may not have been the perfect match for a different firm. So, you know, we look at a lot of different things when we try to make a match.
So last and final question, quickly, for both of you, where are the jobs going to be for 2022? It sounds like everywhere.
Geographically or practice areas?
Practice areas.
Practice areas. M&A, IP,
private equity,
funds, any kind of investment funds.
Yeah. Yes. In California, we're seeing a lot of litigation and a lot of labor and employment, those as well.
Labor and employment is a big, especially now with the mandates, it's going to be big.
Right. And California has always sort of been hot for labor and employment because California is its own country when it comes to labor laws. I mean, in just the state, we are very employee friendly. And so some national firms and national corporations want to make sure they have employment lawyers that know California law, because they figure if you could do it in Cal, if you can practice employment law in California, you can practice it anywhere. So they want to make sure that they have somebody here to handle it. And we're just dying looking for those. So litigators and employment lawyers, as well as the corporate folk.
All right. That's everything I have for both of you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Stephanie. It was very nice.
Thank you. It was fun.
It was.
Yeah. And listeners, thank you for joining us. If you like what you heard today, please rate us on Apple Podcasts. We'll see you next time for another episode of the ABA Journal's Asked and Answered.